Slate Money is brought to you by Harry's, the shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door. Visit harrys.com for $5 off your first purchase with the promo code MONEY. And by Wonder Capital. Invest in large-scale solar projects across the U.S. Create an account for free at wondercapital.com/money. That's Wonder with a U. Invest in Wonder Capital's solar funds. Do well and do good. And by Open Account, a podcast that gets personable about making, losing, and living with money. Created by Umpqua Bank and hosted by Soojin Park. Download and subscribe to Open Account wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello! And welcome to the Finance versus Business edition of Slate Money, your guide to the entire global economy and or the news of the week. This week, our episode is titled by our special guest, because not only do we have the one and only Cathy O'Neill, the blogger and data scientist.
Hi.
Hi, Cathy. But standing in for Jordan Weissman is someone of much greater stature, the one and only.
Not at all.
Rana Faruha, who's here to, I don't know, just be amazing. You have a book and you kind of have a podcast where it comes out. You have a thing on the radio.
I have a thing on the radio. I do a show regularly called Money Talking on WNYC. I'm CNN's global economic analyst, if that's a weighty
that
enough
sounds,
title
that
for you.
That sounds very impressive.
It is impressive.
Are you also a young global leader?
Not yet. I think I've written too many negative pieces about the WEF. And I am Time Magazine's economic columnist, most importantly.
So Rana has this book called
Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business.
Which is a quite impressively, what's the word? Dyspeptic book, given your status.
That's
at
a $4
Time,
word.
At Time Magazine, which is like the icon of centrism and never really having much in the way of contentious opinions. You have a lot of contentious opinions.
I actually was going to throw in that another title you can give yourself is Occupier. I mean, the stuff you were saying, I was like, well, we talk about this every week.
I would combat Felix's idea about Time, because since I took over economics there, we've been out of the box for some time. It's true.
The mellifluous days of Justin Fox are long gone.
Ooh, okay, not going to touch that.
I love Justin. He's awesome, but he was never a bomb thrower.
Well, Time is, you know, Time actually has an interesting position in the media landscape because we tend to be a top of the market indicator, actually. And the fact that I was able to get my book cover on the cover, you know, as an excerpt, I think really says something about the political tipping point we're at, the economic tipping point we're at. I mean, my thesis is basically that market capitalism is broken, that the financial markets are no longer supporting business, and it's a big problem. So yeah, it's a pretty tough statement.
So we're gonna delve a little bit into a few different aspects of this thesis. I mean, we honestly could spend weeks just talking about this book. There's a huge amount of material in there, but let's start with the sort of 30,000-foot view. And now, what is the name of this episode of the podcast? Remind me again, since you named it.
Finance versus Business.
Okay. Now, what's the contradiction in there? Isn't finance something that all businesses need in order to be able to thrive?
Well, finance started out as something that was supposed to be a catalyst to business, right? So, you know, if you think about market capitalism as envisioned by Adam Smith, it's finance helping invest everybody's savings into new enterprises. But I would argue that since basically the early 1970s, that role has been changing now, and finance has become the game. It's sort of, you know, the tail wagging the dog, and business is now in service in large part to the capital markets rather than the other way around.
You spend a lot of time talking about GM and how GM was taken over from the car guys to the business guys and the finance, and with the finance perspective. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, totally. Because one of the key sources on this book is a guy named Bob Lutz, who was the vice chairman of GM for a long time. And he wrote a book a few years back called Car Guys Versus Bean Counters. And it was really about the cult of the MBA within the auto industry and how that came to be. And he just, there was a little snippet about Robert McNamara, who was, of course, you know, the engineer of the Vietnam failed efforts in the U.S. In the Vietnam War, and also ran Ford for a time, and brought this whole idea of hyper-focus on very kind of siloed metrics to the entire auto industry, and then later to many blue-chip U.S. companies, because a lot of his alums from Ford actually spread out into U.S. industry. And, you know, Lutz thought, and I came to feel as I reported on GM, that this was one of the big reasons for their ignition switch crisis a couple of years ago. Because, you know, they had these divisions that were not talking to one another. And the root cause of that was that the CFO, the CFO's office and the sort of MBAs were running everything rather than the engineers. And it was just this diametric change. And I began to think about that in the larger context of how the money guys had taken over business.
And of course, it's not just General Motors, it's also General Electric, which was officially a too-big-to-fail bank during the financial crisis. I mean, GM had GMAC, which was a financial arm, which more or less outgrew the sort of car bit.
This is something
which we've seen quite a lot, is that you can make more money with money than you can by making stuff. That if you look at the... you know, the rich lists, there's a lot of hedge fund managers and bankers and financiers as opposed to actual what you call makers.
Yeah. No.
And you even have like that really startling statistic that only 15% of money that's floating around and going through the financial system is actually going towards investment.
Yeah. No, it's an amazing stat. It comes
now,
out.
What's the time series on that? Is that much lower than it used to be, or has it always been low?
It's much lower. It's gone down. It's halved really since the 1970s, and it was. It's been going down since the post-war era. And this is really deep academic research. And just to break that number down a little bit, so 15% of all the money flowing out of U.S. financial institutions, and actually many other countries. This is not a story that's unique to the U.S. In fact, the U.K. is in some ways more financialized, as you know, Felix. 15% of that money is going into business investment. So where's the rest of it going? It's going into the buying and selling of existing assets, so stocks, bonds, houses. You know, you can argue maybe that the mortgage business is productive in some ways. People buy homes and then they buy stuff, but it's less productive statistically than investing in new businesses, growing new enterprises.
And just to be clear, when I rack up a bunch of stupid debt on my credit card, is that part of the 15%? Or is that part of the 85%?
Yeah, that's kind of the 85%. Actually, that's a whole. That's another thing that's bad that I cover in my book. I have a whole chapter, in fact, on debt and how, you know, debt, the reason that we have grown debt so exponentially, not just in the U.S. but elsewhere, is that debt is the lifeblood of finance. You know, it is where finance makes its money, issuing debt increasingly. And the tax code in the U.S. actually really supports this in ways that I think are very unhealthy.
All the way over there, I want to bring us back to sort of this finance taking over business concept. And I think you make a really interesting case about the way business schools themselves have evolved and what business school used to be and what it is now, which are training those bean counters, as it were, in the GM. Can you talk a little bit about what business school used to be?
Yeah, well, so business school used to be much more like what you would find in a kind of a Germanic model. It was sort of a trade school for corporate leaders. So if you were going to work in the packaged goods industry or in the manufacturing industry, you would probably go to a business school in an area of the country where that industry was located that was focused on that particular industry. Finance was kind of secondary as it was in the economy. But this is another thing I got actually from Bob Lutz, who told me he went to business school before he knew better, kind of like sailors get tattoos, which really struck me. Business schools, in part because of McNamara, who ran Harvard Business School, began really putting finance at the center of things. And so now Finance 101 is really the core curriculum for MBA students. And by the way, Finance 101 and Econ 101 is still very much efficient markets theory, right? I mean, you know...
For
eight years on from the financial crisis.
And the weird thing is that this applies even to bankers, that in the sort of platonic ideal of how banking works is that you have a branch manager of a bank in Kansas, and the branch manager of the bank in Kansas makes loans to local businesses and actually understands the agricultural industry really well and knows a lot about wheat and doesn't really know anything about finance because he doesn't need to know very much about finance. What he needs to know is about wheat and farming and like whether these loans to farmers are going to get paid back.
Right.
And what's happened in finance, as well as just, you know, the real economy, is that all of those little local pockets of industry knowledge in the banking sector have been replaced by some incomprehensible algorithm, and bankers basically only know about finance anymore. And that makes it much harder to get those sort of idiosyncratic loans.
True enough. And in fact, you know, this kind of has, just to wonk out for a minute on history, this has some pretty deep roots. It goes back to the split between Hamilton and Jefferson about the banking structure in the U.S. And what it should be. And if Hamilton, of course, wanted it to be big and national and unified, and Jefferson, who was sort of representing the small agrarian farmers of the South, wanted it to be very local. And interestingly, what we ended up with is a bit of a hash-up, a mix of the two. So you got a national system where investment banking, commercial banking was combined, but there were laws that prevented regional commercial banks from merging for a long time. So you didn't have these kind of local, it's a wonderful life type bankers that could then grow and spread risk nationally the way you do in the Canadian system, for example, which is, I think, much more secure because of that.
So one of the things that you already mentioned is like a negative consequence of business being taken over by finance is the GM ignition problem.
Yeah.
And we also talked about like loans to small businesses being less thoughtful. What are the other negative consequences of this?
Well, you know, just going back to what Felix was saying about GE being a too big to fail bank until recently, you know, the more financialized a company becomes, I think the more volatile its share price is, the more risk it has. Just to give you a sense statistically, and then I'll give you a couple color examples. Since the 1980s onwards, American industry has gotten five times as much revenue from financial activities as it did in the early 1980s. So huge increase there. And this is everything from the sort of, you know, credit servicing to customers that certain companies might do, to tax optimization, to hedging. I mean, hedging, for example, is an interesting thing because energy companies, transport companies, you can argue that they need to hedge the price of oil, but there's plenty of airlines that have gotten deeply, deeply into this business, and then they're not so good at it.
So there's been all of these headlines as the price of oil has plunged to these crazy historic lows. I've been seeing all of these headlines about how the airlines are taking off their oil hedges, which just seems to be insane.
They're like playing at exactly the wrong time in the market. But the bottom line is that they undermine their own business model by creating more volatility in the commodities markets by getting into this game.
So let me ask you, because I don't want this to just be a sort of fulsome and effulgent praise of your book, because that would be boring.
Of course not.
Let me ask you, like, is there not a case for financialization? Is there not a case that, say, an aggressive and ambitious company like Tesla or Uber can get billions of dollars of investment from the finance world and use those billions of dollars to really kind of change the planet in a way that might not have been possible from your local bank?
For sure. But then, you know, it's interesting that you bring up Uber as an example, because that gets into a whole nother paradigm of what financialization has done to the tech industry. And I think in recent years, you could argue that it's really taken a lot of big tech companies kind of away from what we think of as the Silicon Valley model of really innovating, spending a lot of time on technology. I don't want to get so much into Uber because I think that that's kind of another story, but let me talk about Apple for just a minute, because that, I think, is a very interesting story of a company that's become quite financialized. So I would argue, and some people might argue differently, but I would say that I don't think there's been a real game-changing technology from Apple since Steve Jobs died in 2011. And the share price has been wobbly over that time. I mean, it's definitely sunk at various points. And so the company has spent a lot of money issuing debt at very low rates, which, of course, we have because of the financial crisis, to pay back money and buy back stock, which makes investors like Carl Icahn very happy until quite recently he was tweeting about every 2 seconds that they should do more buybacks and the stock price would get jacked up artificially because, of course, that's what share buybacks do. But then the minute that there was bad news, real bad news, a decision taken by the Chinese which would affect the market share potentially in the Chinese market, Icahn dumps the stock. I mean, Buffett came in and bought it. But the whole point is that this creates a very volatile game that these companies play. By the way, there's another kind of Kafka-esque element to all this, which is that Apple, of course, is more involved in the capital markets at a time when it doesn't need any capital. You know, it's got $200 billion in money sitting overseas and much of it in offshore accounts. Now, of course, it doesn't want to bring that money back and pay the U.S. Tax rate. And you can make an argument that that's a very smart thing to do. But it just shows you how kind of Kafka-esque the market system has
been. Right, that is the perfect segue to the next segment where I want to really talk to you about this question of stock buybacks and whether they're good or bad, whether Apple spending billions of dollars buying back its stock is bad for Apple, whether it means that there's a sort of opportunity cost, which is the implication not only of that particular example, but kind of your entire book. If it was doing less of that, then it would be doing more of the other. But before we go into this whole question of stock buybacks, I need to thank the sponsor of Slate Money this week, which is Harry's Razors, which are this wonderful combination of American and Germanic in a weird way.
A maker.
They're a maker. They make razors in Germany in a factory, which they bought with $100 million, which they raised in venture capital in America.
Oh, fabulous.
You see, so it's a nice little combination.
It is. You know how I feel about the Germans.
They took their money, they invested it into a real factory, and now they make these razors, which have 5 blades, and they shave you super smooth.
So German. And love it.
It's great. And you can get a great shave, and you can get a whole starter kit. If you go to harrys.com, harrys.com, for $10, which is kind of amazing. You get the razors and you get the little non-slip handle and the shave cream and 3 of those amazing, like, 5-blade razors.
Buy my husband one.
Buy your husband one, and it's all of $10 because it's a $15 kit minus $5 off the first purchase, which you get with the promo code money. So you go to harrys.com, put the promo code money in, and then when you love it, you can just set up a subscription thing and they just arrive automatically, and it's so much cheaper than if you go to the drugstore and buy, like, the brand razors. Clever,
right? Sigh of satisfaction.
Financialization at work.
Makers.
So, okay, so back to this question of Apple.
Actually, can we before we go into Apple, can we talk a little bit about makers and takers?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I found it pretty fascinating how you redefined those terms away from the Romney version.
Well, I was so it was actually Paul Ryan that first used those terms, and Romney popularized it for sure. But Ryan first used those terms in the 2012 election cycle, you know, to refer to the 47% of Americans that were not paying any income tax, and apparently the capitalists that were doing all the good things and that we should be so happy about. And I just found it really, really offensive. I mean, I'll come clean here and say I grew up in the Rust Belt. I grew up in a tiny town in rural Indiana. My dad is an electrical engineer. He's an immigrant. He ran and runs a small manufacturing business. So I have a little prejudice towards makers, you know. But I just found that so wrong-headed, because if you look over the last 20 years, trickle-down theory, which is basically what that version of makers and takers is playing off of, just hasn't worked, right? I mean, you know, we do not have a system in which the owners of capital are actually producing greater prosperity for the whole right now, and we just need to look more carefully at why that is. And so I wanted to flip those terms. And, you know, I was really galvanized. One of the key statistics in my book is that the financial sector as a whole, so not just banks, but insurance, mutual funds, you know, kind of the larger finance industry, creates 4% of jobs in this country, but it takes between 25% and 30% of all the corporate profits in the country. So that number to me is like the oxygen is being sucked out of the room.
The thing which strikes me about that statistic is that if the finance industry was efficient,
yeah, right, exactly,
then it would be a tiny sliver. Then all of those profits would be competed away, yeah, and they would do their intermediation at incredibly low cost, and they would have low cost, hyper efficient capital allocation services, which made very little money.
You've just hit the nail on the head, because over the last 40 years, as finance has gotten bigger, it's also gotten more expensive. It's just the exact opposite of what's supposed to happen. There are no economies of scale here.
Everything else in the world gets cheaper as you get more of it, except for finance, which gets more expensive.
So let's
come back to this question of Apple and stock buybacks, because Apple is this hugely successful company. Now, you're right, it hasn't innovated very much in the past few years, although there's no particular reason to believe, in my mind, that, you know, past performance is a great indicator of future innovation. The question is, what is it meant to do with all of these billions of dollars of profit that it's earning? You know, we've seen in the pharmaceutical industry over and over again that just because you're making billions of dollars doesn't mean you can just magically create innovation out of thin air. And we've seen with Apple that even when you're not making billions of dollars, you can be incredibly innovative. There doesn't seem to be any correlation whatsoever between innovation and profit. So what are they meant to do with the profits if not return it to the shareholders?
Okay, so I want to come to that question, but first I want to hit something on pharmaceuticals, because actually I have a whole chapter in my book about the pharmaceutical industry, which is the most financialized of any industry. And in fact, there was this really famous Morgan Stanley report in 2010 that argued that the pharmaceutical industry, which like is responsible for coming up with drugs to make us healthier and save lives, should just give up R&D altogether and just essentially do financialized investing, do mergers that would kick up the share price, do buybacks.
And that's what Valiant did,
Right. I mean,
I'm kind of sympathetic to this because the pharmaceutical industry, if you look at history, is really bad at R&D. Mm-hmm. It's much better to allow the small little biotech industries to do the R&D. And then when they've managed to come up with some wonderful drug, then you acquire that biotech company for some vast amount of money, and then you have a new drug. That's a much more efficient form of R&D than just spending a whole bunch of money, which we've seen over and over and again from pharmaceutical companies, not only in the US, but also in the UK and also in Switzerland. It just doesn't turn into innovation.
I'm not a lab scientist, but I'm assuming that there are certain projects you simply can't do with that model, right? I mean, if you have real money, you can do a bigger kind of experiment.
Well, it's interesting. Felix, actually, you have a point in the sense that there is a model. And actually, Andrew Lowe at MIT, who is a financial professor, is sort of doing some work around coming up with this for the NIH to essentially create
prizes. Like the prize model?
I don't know about the prize model. But
okay, let's go back to Andrew.
Okay. So, but the point is that, yeah, a big pharma company could act in a way like a VC, right? Picking from amongst these biotech companies. But right now, they're acting like giant portfolio companies. That model is much less profitable and stable, I would argue, over the long haul than actually the model you're talking about. But it's a different model. I mean, you could bring that power and that money to funding real innovation. But right now, you're just, you know, these pharma companies look like portfolio management companies where nothing connects to each other.
Right. And I'm saying, well, to be clear, I'm saying that they don't need to fund the innovation. That you can fund the innovation in the equity capital markets and the venture capital markets, where you get a bunch of venture capital and risk capital going into the biotechnology sector. And then if one of those biotechnology companies winds up with a blockbuster drug, that company becomes incredibly valuable and inevitably winds up being bought by Sanofi or someone big like that.
Can I make it – I'm sorry. Mm. Just like this model, which I haven't – we haven't discussed this before. But like imagine you do that with, you know, research writ large.
I'm not saying you do this with research.
I'm just saying, but if you did that, you're –
I'm just saying you can't – That historically speaking, if you look at the big pharmaceutical companies, they're not very good at basic research. That generally happens in the academy. Mm. And they're not very good at inventing drugs. And if you can take that money and instead take it out of the big pharmaceutical companies, which are bad at creating drugs, and give it to a whole bunch of little baby companies, which are much more incentivized to create drugs. I'm not convinced that's not a good thing.
Well, I'm not sure that that actually, and this is kind of another whole other podcast about the nature of what's needed in drug development innovation. I'm not sure that that actually tackles the problems of today that would require lots of de-siloing across different areas of research, because you would have lots of independent projects operating separately. But you're hitting on another point that actually I would love to mention, which is that a lot of basic research was done by the U.S. government. And this actually connects to what your question about Apple and, okay, what is the point of Apple? What should it be doing? How should the company be run? Should it be run simply for the benefit of shareholders, or is there some larger group of stakeholders that we should be taking into account? And I would argue that there is something a little weird about a company where, you know, you look at the iPhone and pretty much every part of that device that is smart was funded by basic U.S. government research. And yet you have now, you know, the world's most successful corporation taking just enormous profits, putting them in offshore bank accounts so that the U.S. government cannot get a share of them, and handing back money to the richest Americans, creating the wealth divide, enlarging it, making less jobs than the previous generation of tech companies did. That just doesn't work. I don't think that that sustains an economy like the U.S., and I think that you just have to rethink. And there are other governments. I mean, Israel, Norway, there are different ways of dealing with this sort of paradigm.
Okay, can I just jump in and say, yeah, like, we've talked a couple of times about the buybacks that Apple's done. But as I understood in your book, and until reading it, I didn't really get this, they're not actually buying back stocks with their profit. What they're doing is they're leaving their profit offshore to avoid taxes and then borrowing money from the market and then distributing that money. So it is entirely a way to avert taxes.
Yes, that's right. And can I just, one more thing that Apple does that's amazing, which Bloomberg has covered very well, actually, is that a lot of these big tech giants actually now underwrite corporate bond offerings the same way that, say, a Goldman Sachs used to do. So, I mean, they have so much cash on hand that they're acting like banks now, but they're not regulated like banks. I mean, it's just an interesting paradigm.
They're a huge buy-side investors, right? And
but it's much less transparent.
Tend not to be particularly regulated, and that, you know, we can talk about whether or not that's a good thing. But we have this situation where Apple is throwing off huge profits, mostly outside the U.S. Those profits are staying outside the U.S. for tax reasons. It's leveraging itself up inside the U.S. because some, you know, bean counter MBA type reckons that they need a slightly different balance sheet, and it's better to have a bit more debt and a bit less equity, which, fine, if that's how they want it. I don't, you know, it doesn't, no skin off my nose. I agree with you that the tax treatment of debt makes that a little bit too attractive, and that we should make equity more attractive and debt less attractive. But the bigger question, which I still have for you, you know, short of like going back 40 years and making the U.S. government some major stakeholder in Apple with a right to Apple's profits, what is Apple meant to do right now with its profits?
I think it's an open question, but I think that conversation is being had at the highest levels. I mean, it's interesting. The Obama administration has taken meetings with some of the tech CEOs to talk about this issue, the fact that they are so incredibly cash rich, that they offshore a lot of money, that they create fewer and fewer jobs. I mean, just think about, forget about Apple for a minute, think about Uber, think about WhatsApp, think about, you know, the next generation of tech firms that create even fewer jobs.
I feel
jobs
like
relative.
Apple has created an enormous number of jobs, mostly in China, but still a lot.
But less than GM or GE would have created. It's the scale of the way technology is interacting with finance. You get companies that can have the same market share as the corporate giants of the past, but create fewer jobs. So the point is, the administration has actually taken meetings with these companies to say, what can we do about it? And they're bouncing around a lot of crazy ideas, you know, everything from kind of, you know, writing checks to people to, you know, for the value of their data to who knows what. But it's a conversation that's being had because the current model is very fragile.
And Can I just jump in and say, like, I don't think it's a question of, I mean, a lot of people do think about it morally speaking. They're like, oh, Apple, those jerks.
No, I don't think about
and
that
I,
way.
Yeah, no, and I think one of the things I like about your book is that you're just basically saying this is actually what makes sense for them to do. And in some sense, you could describe financialization as the way that people in business have sort of taken that to the nth degree. What makes sense for us?
Yeah.
And they figure out that like these crazy, you know, offshoring and tax inversion, blah, 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 all that stuff, which is totally financialized.
Yeah.
Is actually good for their company in this current system. So
that's
the question always is, how do we change the system?
It's the incentive. I mean, and that's kind of what I was trying to do in the book, is in some ways just shine a light on, here are all the really bizarre incentives that we have in the market right now, and here are the behaviors that they incentivize. By the way, just to kind of bring this kind of totally full circle, one of the fascinating things that I've found since my book has gone out in the market, I had thought that I would be getting a lot of calls from Fortune 500 CEOs that were like, yeah, great, you're standing, I mean, we're under so much pressure from the activists of the world, we love your book. Not at all. I mean, they're just afraid of their boards and they're trying to last for 3 to 5 years. I've been getting calls from financiers and hedge fund guys that are super interested in this because it's about growth. Ultimately, it's about, are we incentivizing broad, deep economic growth at a time when, you know, whatever you want to call it, the 2% economy, secular stagnation, is this model actually creating underlying growth? Because at some point, Main Street and the markets do connect in that way, and the finance guys know it.
And that's my big question for you, which I've put in a couple of different ways, but let me just try and boil it down to, do we really think that there's a cost in terms of growth to the financialization of the economy? Is it the case that all of this money, if it was taken out of the financial sector and somehow put to better use, would make the economy stronger, grow faster, make the middle class richer again, and so forth? Is that something which we can credibly believe?
I would say yes. And actually, there's some pretty deep studies. I mean, the BIS and the IMF have both done a lot of research looking at the size of finance as a percentage of GDP in economies. And basically what it finds is, yes, after it gets too big, it is a headwind to GDP growth. And it actually, that effect kicks in when finance is half the size of what it is in the U.S.
And that's intuitively correct as well, because finance, you know, we get obsessed with the stock market, but the real engine of finance is the bond market, and bonds are basically how, you know, just like governments and individuals get crippled by debt, you know, bonds are debt, and if you have to pay huge amounts of debt to your bondholders, that's going to make it more difficult for you to be a really good company.
And you could also look directly, because you have a chapter on consumer debt, like the debtification of the average consumer has not really helped their quality of life.
No, and actually it's in an interesting way, it's a marker of how deeply financialized the economy is, because consumer debt grows in part because there's not underlying wage growth. And so the government, you know, each president, each administration, Republican and Democrat, starts taking policy decisions to keep people happy, to paper over this slower growth paradigm, which has been here since the 70s, and kind of pass the bucks to the market and say, you know, we don't want to deal with that, create some financialized growth. I mean, Rajan was fantastic on this.
Let them eat student debt.
Let them eat student debt, exactly.
And it is true that in the short term, if you rapidly increase the amount of debt in a sector or in an economy, that's going to create this kind of sugar high.
Yeah.
But over the long term, that's unsustainable. What that means for China is for something else, another podcast entirely. But I want to move on to the other huge part of the finance industry, which we haven't even touched on yet, which is the other huge part of what Adair Turner in the UK calls socially useless capital. It's not just bonds and stocks. It's also houses. And so, but before we go on to houses, I want to talk about another, form of financialization, which is solar panels. Oh. Solar panels are an interesting investment because they are ethically happy, you know, they help save the world from global warming. We basically want to maximize the amount of renewable energy that we have in the economy. And one of the easiest ways of maximizing the amount of renewable energy in the economy is by slapping solar panels on everything. And ideally, people would just reach into their pockets and pay a bunch of cash for these solar panels. But as we know, a lot of people don't have a lot of cash lying around. And so what you wind up with is this financial opportunity, basically, that you can finance the installation of solar panels around the U.S. economy and get yourself a decent return on the order of 11% or so, and have more solar panels in America, which is a good thing, not only financially, but also for the planet. Mm. So the way you do this, if you want to do this through a Slate Money sponsor, is to go to Wunder Capital, W-U-N-D-E-R, Wunder with a U, which is based in Boulder, Colorado, which is, and it make and it allows investors to invest in solar projects, not just in Colorado, but everywhere. And you have two choices. You can go into the Wunder Income Fund, which gives you 6% over a 10-year period, or the Bridge Fund, which gives you 11% over a 2-year period. And it's all to be found at wondercapital.com/money. Wondercapital.com/money. Okay, housing.
I'm so fascinated by this topic because I've been sitting in horror.
Yeah.
Post-financial crisis.
Yeah.
Watching all these private equity groups buying up the foreclosed houses. And you really, you're also horrified.
I am.
I want you to share that with me.
I want to bond over my horror.
They're the liquidity providers. Let me take the devil's advocate position here.
Which is okay.
Let's first of all put things in perspective. If you live like I do in New York City, you have seen house prices rebound enormously from the financial crisis. And in fact, they didn't even fall that much in the financial crisis. If you're in Miami, you're in another little baby housing bubble. If you're in London or Vancouver, house prices are through the roof. And everyone's like, wow, everything's rebounded. That's not true. If you go to Ferguson, Missouri, more than half of the houses in Ferguson, Missouri are still underwater from mortgages which were taken out before the financial crisis. If you go to Detroit, if you go to Baltimore, if you even go to areas around Oakland, California, which you think of as having this big housing boom, there's a lot of underwater people there.
Totally. There's actually this great conference board study that about 60% of all the gains in the housing market since 2008 have been in the top 10 markets. So it's really, really bifurcated.
It's the rich people where they live versus everyone else.
That's
and
right.
So, if you're not in San Francisco or Washington or New York, then it's a very different kettle of fish. But here's the problem. If you're in Ferguson or somewhere like that, or Baltimore or the south side of Chicago, is that your house is worth so little that on an absolute basis, it could be worth $30,000, $40,000. These are cheap houses. Now, cheap houses in principle are good things.
That's what I was going to say. Why is it bad? Okay. I mean, we all feel sorry for the people underwater. I get it.
But in principle, cheap houses are affordable housing, and we all like affordable housing, especially when incomes are not rising. We want to be able to afford, our roof over our heads. But here's the problem. If you're poor enough to be one of these people looking to live in a $40,000 house, you don't have $40,000 in cash to pay for that house. You need to finance it. Under Dodd-Frank, mortgage companies are not allowed to charge more than 2 or 3% for a mortgage. It is not economical for anyone to give out a $40,000 mortgage with 2 or 3% fees. It just doesn't make sense. And so the result is that there's no liquidity in these markets. Basically, these houses can't be bought. They can't be sold because they're underwater. They can't be bought because no one can get financing. And there's no way to get the market moving again. The market isn't clearing. So the least worst option in some weird way is for Blackstone to come in. Is it BlackRock or Blackstone? I can't remember. It's Blackstone. Blackstone to come in and start buying up these houses at $40,000 a pop and renting them out. Now, we know that, in terms of the amount of house proud, like the maintenance that people do on their homes and the quality of the neighborhoods and the quality of schools generally goes up if people are owners rather than renters. But at least you have a clearing market now and some option for people to be able to move into those houses, pay rent, and be affordable.
Are we going to be allowed to talk?
I have a whole chapter on this. I'm ready whenever you are.
Let's hear it.
Okay, so chapter 7 of my book is this. And listen, let me start by saying saying you're making a valid point that you have to have someone in these markets that are really, really beleaguered, like what you're talking about, put a floor on the market at some point. And there were places like this all over. I spent a lot of time in the Inland Empire in California right after the financial crisis. San Bernardino, Stockton, some of those places were really, really hard hit and still trying to kind of, you know, wade their way out of the crisis. And interestingly, Blackstone has become, via Invitation Homes, which is one of its subsidiaries, one of the biggest landlords in these places. And in fact, Blackstone is the biggest single family homeowner in America now, which is kind of amazing. Now, okay, you can argue that they came into some of these markets and put a floor on, but here's the rub. The reason that they were able to do that is twofold. One, the traditional banks were hamstrung from doing this in part because regulations dating way back to the 70s actually make it difficult for them to do that without writing in clauses to keep housing affordable for local communities. There's a lot more sort of check and balance on what the big banks can do in housing. Private equity didn't have those checks and balances because it's much less regulated. What happened right after the crisis is while the entire country was busy dealing with the too big to fail banks, private equity came in and just bought up all of these amazing deals on the courthouse steps. There were no provisions saying you had to keep a certain percentage of the housing affordable. You had to have certain provisions about how you acted as a landlord when you started renting all these properties out. And as a result, not in every neighborhood, but in a lot of neighborhoods, you have unemployment rates that are higher than the national average, but rents that are also higher than the average. So you don't have a market that's reflecting the economic reality on the ground.
I mean, I'm thinking like, I've been skeptical for a long time about this American dream of you have to have a house.
Yeah, well, that's true.
But and it's so theoretically, it's okay to have landlords. But the question is whether these are responsible landlords. And
right.
It doesn't look like they are. They're raising rents and making things unaffordable for the people living there.
Yeah,
and it's not
also
particularly a good place to live anyway.
Talk about an industry that's really populated by makers. I mean, landlording is a very mom and pop business, right? I mean, talk about something where you really need to know your customer. You know, you need to, you're in these people's homes, you know, and this is not something I would think that a private equity company is particularly well set up to do. And there have been a lot of community activists that have done reports around Invitation Homes, a lot of complaints about how these properties get taken care of. I tried to actually do a big interview with them for my book, and they declined. So I don't have a whole lot of information
about
that.
But we have some idea because you talked a little bit about how distant the landlords are, how
that's
you can't
right.
actually even find the person to complain to.
Well, that's right. And that's a key thing because I did speak to some community activists and civic leaders that said, you know, private equity can work when it's more closely tied to the community, that they've had much better experiences with local players that are invested, that are not going to cut and run, that have a reason to be there and stay in the community. But, you know, you're raising another point, which people like Bob Shiller, the Nobel winner from Yale, have said, which is that should our economy revolve so much around housing? And that's a whole other question. The problem is that all the pieces work together. I mean, you know, homes are still where most middle class people keep their wealth. And until we kind of rejigger the entire system, I think you can't argue that we should become a renter society en masse.
So I'm a huge believer that we have far too much home ownership in the UK. I mean, sorry, in the US, but certainly in the UK
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, definitely.
For that matter. That it's damaging because it impedes labor mobility. If you own a house, it makes it much harder to move somewhere else for a better job. Mm-hmm. And it is a highly leveraged financial asset, which, as we saw during the financial crisis, can really bite you during the point at which you don't want it to bite you. I feel like everyone would be much better off if we were just Germany and everyone rented.
Unless you were Italy, and then you'd be really sad if everyone was Germany.
but the big thing is that...
Can I just echo that? I mean, the fact is we're better off if we have a consistent rent every month, and the risk is on the private equity guys. I don't have a problem with that setup. I just want them to be good landlords.
Well, okay, the problem is that the way that the US is set up right now is that you have essentially rental ghettos. You have
that's right.
vast areas where everyone owns their home, and then vast areas where no one owns their home and everyone rents. Yeah. And that's the worst of all possible worlds.
That's right.
Because what happens is that the rental neighborhoods tend to be poorer, they have worse schools, yeah. that you don't get any of the ancillary benefits from having homeowners. And what we need to do is have much more renting in high-income neighborhoods and much more owning in low-income neighborhoods, and that would be a better mix. I just don't know how we get there from
here.
Well,
it's interesting. I mean, housing policy, getting the right housing policy is a huge part of getting the makers and takers situation right.
So the first thing we can all agree on is yeah. that we need to abolish the mortgage interest tax deduction,
oh,
right?
Oh, God, yes. And I, you know, I'm going to come mm-hmm. clean and just say, like, I live in a brownstone in Brooklyn, and there is no way without that tax deduction I would be living in that brownstone.
But without that tax deduction, it wouldn't have cost as much.
That's right.
It inflates prices.
It so inflates. I mean, it is crazy. I thought I bought at the top of the market in 2007. Nope. You know, it's nuts what those deductions do and how they distort the market. We really should abolish them.
Okay. So I think that's probably what we have time for in terms of the book, but I have a feeling you're going to squeeze something in the numbers round, which is
yes.
going to be book related.
It is. It's
going to be book related. But before we move on to the numbers round, I need to talk about Open Account, which is a podcast created by Umpqua Bank and hosted by Soojin Park, which talks less about these huge, big macro issues and more about the day-to-day micro issues around money and how awkward it can be and how it's connected to culture and power and class and emotions and how difficult it is to just basically face a huge amount of these issues surrounding personal finance and money. So Soojin Park is the host. She has...
Can I just say that I was... like nervous the entire time I read the like retirement
oh,
chapter.
God, I know.
So I
know.
Maybe I should listen to this podcast. The retirement chapter made me want to like commit suicide.
I know.
So you have two choices, Kathy. Like yeah. number one, you can like try and deal with this, or number two, you can put your head in the sand.
Let's do that.
Yeah. I feel okay. like denial is yeah. nearly always the right thing to do. But if you feel like peeking out from you know, picking one eyeball out from within the sand, one way of doing that is to subscribe to Open Account, which you can find in any Apple or podcasting store. It's very easy to find. Of course, it's free. So download and subscribe to Open Account in Overcast or Stitcher or the iTunes store, wherever you find your podcasts. Okay, so numbers.
Yeah. I have a sad number this week. I don't know about you guys, but I've been reading a lot about Venezuela and what a terrible
yeah,
situation
that's
is.
That's a disaster.
So the rate of death among babies under a month old has risen by 100-fold since 2012, and it's now at 2%, which is really a lot.
That's really scary. So that's like medieval.
It is medieval.
It is medieval.
Yeah, it's awful.
I'm going to just swiftly move on from that because there's nothing I can say about that. My number is 671,000, which is the number of papers which are freely available on everybody around this table's favorite website, which is SSRN, the Social Science Research Network. I know that Rana shares my – like we go there the time to look things up. SSRN has just been bought by Elsevier.
Really? Oh, No.
Wait, are my free PDFs going away?
Are they
going
to charge?
So we can only hope that Elsevier is not going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg.
Oh, my God.
But people are not happy about this.
All these numbers. My number is depressing, too.
What's your number?
I'm so sorry, but it's 4. It's a small number, but a depressing number. $4. Of debt is what it takes to create every dollar of growth in China now. And China, you're right, I am going to find a way to connect this to makers and takers, the rise of finance and the fall of American business. China is the next theater of financialization because China not only has this incredible debt crisis that everybody knows about, but it is in an interestingly similar political situation to what the U.S. was in the late 60s and early 70s when U.S. growth started slowing and we had these administrations that passed the buck to the financial markets. The Chinese are in that position too. Their growth has slowed. They need a new paradigm. There's a big fight going on as to whether it's going to be financialized growth or something different.
So $4 of debt per dollar of growth. Yes. That's more or less the same as we have in the U.S. Right?
Well, but five, six years ago in China, it was a dollar to dollar, you know? So that's a run-up that is incredible. And as we know, the pace of increase in debt is more important than the sheer amount.
It's not looking good.
That's a quick yet depressing numbers round.
You're welcome.
I'm just going to end this podcast at this point because I need to go stick my head in a bucket of something. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Thank you for all of your feedback and letters. We love them. You can always email us at slatemoney@slate.com. Thank you to Audrey Quinn for producing and to Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers, the executive producers here at the Panoply Network at itunes.com/panoply. But most of all, thank you to the one and only Rana Faruha. Her book is available in all good bookstores and even at a fang-like Amazon, if you want to do it that way.
Anyway, buy it anywhere you
Amazon want. Doesn't make profit, so we should just support them, right?
I highly recommend this book. It's really excellent.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, and we will talk to you all next week on Slate Money.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.